Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have three interviews for you today, and they all concern entertaining and interesting children's books. The first interview, brand new, newly recorded, is with one of the most renowned children's book authors before the public today, Carmen Agradidi, talking about her latest book, which is called Carina Felina, her refreshing take on an old Caribbean folktale. We'll have two other interviews for you right after that from the Morning Show archives. I hope you enjoy them all. Here is part one. And what a pleasure and honor it is for me to be speaking for the next few minutes with one of our country's most admired authors of children's books. Her name, Carmen Agradidi. And it is very possible that you have heard some of her contributions to National Public Radio over the years. She is a superb storyteller and the author of a number of different important books for children, including The Rooster Who Would Not Be Quiet, Rita and Ralph's Rotten Day, Martina the Beautiful Cockroach, and the newest book, which we are talking about today, called Carina Felina. And I'm excited to speak with her about this and her other work and about the importance of fostering a love of reading and storytelling among our young people. Carmen Agradidi, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, why, thank you. I feel red carpeted, frankly. I hope I can live up to this.
Well, that was my intention. I'm happy to speak with you. Ahead of us talking about Carina Felina, I wonder if you would tell our listeners, for the sake of those who don't know it, your intriguing personal story in terms of where you were born versus where you have made your life and home since then.
Okay. So I was born in Havana in 1960. I came when I was a child with my parents and my sister, and we entered the U.S. in 1964. And I grew up in a little town in Georgia called Decatur. And yo hablo español porque yo me crié en una familia cubana. I speak Spanish because I grew up in a Cuban family and we spoke Spanish. But I also grew up in the South, so when I first learned English, I had a little bit of a Southern accent, which was crazy when it blended with a Cuban accent. So it was a very interesting, it's a twist on Southern Gothic, I think, my upbringing. So I grew up hearing wonderful stories from Cuban storytellers, my father foremost. He just had a very natural gift. And so, you know, those stories were, había una vez, había un niño que vivía dentro de una rosa. And so it has this lovely sound to it, right? You don't even have to think of the words. And then you might go down to the hardware store with a bunch of kids, which we did because we were all feral children at the time, and there could be some old men out there, and one of them would kind of glance our way like they didn't really quite see us or acknowledge us and say to the other man, so, Bill, did I ever tell you about that three-legged dog? And then, of course, we would all sidle up, and a story would start. I don't think you could go 3 feet without hearing a story when I was a child. But then people talked to one another a lot.
That's key, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And in the absence of, because, you know, and this is not even, this isn't me even being a Luddite. I'm not saying that I'm not. I am in part, but I use all of the devices. And as you must, because look at your line of work. We have to.
Right.
However, isn't it sad to go someplace from a doctor's office to a restaurant and see everyone looking down instead of at one another?
Hmm.
They're staring into the void. I do it. And so now I'm making myself take a book, take one of my New York Times crosswords, whatever, anything, so that my mind can return to a time when I had nothing that distracted me. And even on walks now, a lot of times I go on walks and I would do my words with friends. I'm outing myself here, by the way, Greg. But now when I'll walk and I make myself just be in my body and let my mind, it sounds like mindfulness and so forth, and it is to some degree, but it's really more about just, I suppose, stopping. And first, all these thoughts come in, and there's so many. They're just, it feels like your brain is full of white noise. After a little while, it starts to clear, almost the way clouds clear on a rainy day, and all of a sudden it's very, you know, this beautiful sort of blue sky appears, and this azure fills everything. That's how it feels. It feels like my mind is suddenly clear. And that's when the ideas come again.
Mm.
It's hard to be creative. Go ahead.
No, I could not agree more. And of course, great ideas are at the heart of all of these wonderful, intriguing books that you've created for the world. I also wanted to mention when we visit your wonderful, colorful, entertaining website, one of the things that jumped out at me immediately was that, and I don't know to what extent you have specific responsibility for this, but one of the icons that you click on to find, for instance, frequently asked questions and other things is the image of what we used to see in libraries, where you actually check out a book and they take out something, they stamp the date that it's going to be due, and you have these old-fashioned images from old-fashioned libraries, or the way libraries used to be. I suspect that's not an accident.
No, it is not. It is not. My creative life did start with stories, but it was the Petri dish. Was our local library. It was called the Maud M. Berth Public Library, after that august person whom none of us ever met, but an enormous painting of her hung over the desk of the head librarian. And that, you know, I loved the card catalog. I loved the smell of them. They were not, do you remember that they were not acid-free, these books? So they smelled disgusting. I have a friend who describes them as... brace yourselves. You might want to not listen to this. The grown-ups, the kids will love it. 4-day-old monkey vomit. That is his expression. And it is the most horrific thing, but it is an acidic, awful smell. And sometimes the books have even had like little worms that had gone into them. Most of them were made of things like cloth or leather. Many of them were beautiful. I don't know if you remember. Do you remember? Like they would have, well, I'm much older than you are, no doubt. But many of those big books remained for a long time. And they were little works of art, many of them.
Oh, absolutely.
Many of them.
And it felt good to hold them in your hands. And absolutely, you are preaching to the choir here. And I suspect many of our listeners are very sympathetic as well to what you're describing. Well, let's get to this new book before we run out of time, which is such an intriguing book. It's called Carina Felina. It's a very interesting story. Offbeat, to say the least. And we're told at the back that this is actually a retelling of a story that has been around in folklore for a long, long time. Tell us what you know about this story and where it comes from, and what drew you to want to retell it with your own voice.
Okay, I'm going to have to do this in like under a minute. I can do this.
Not quite under a minute.
Well, but I'd like to give you a quick synopsis so that I don't bore your listeners. So the story can be found all over the world. India, as you mentioned, Denmark, there's so many places. My father told me a version of it when I was a little girl. So it imprinted in me in Spanish. But the English version that I wrote is sort of I took the bones of all of those tellings, and that's what you do with a retelling. You get the points of commonality. You know, boy walks into wood, meets bear. All right, everything's the same in that in every single version that you find. Okay, then you keep that, and you go on through the whole story that way, and then you reflush the story. You fill it in with your own dialogue, your own descriptions, your own setting, if you will. And that's what I did with this. And I set it in Havana because it's the country where I was, you know, it's the city where I was born, in the country where I was born. And I love it. Why do I love it? Because it's a cumulative tale. This is a house that Jack built, the old woman who swallowed a fly, the mitten. These are all very similar. They're actual frames. And I love that this voracious cat begins by eating a lovesick parrot who invites her to dinner. What a dumb idea. I mean, the minute you tell the children that, you know, the parrot was in love with this cat and he asked her to dinner, the minute you start saying that to the children, and I tell it, by the way, I tell it as an oral story, especially the really lively ones in the audience, and you always said those, they are vociferous. Don't do it! What is she thinking? Mm-hmm. Oh, man, she's going to eat him up! Because kids are smarter than we are. and they see it coming way before we do. Because think about it, it's a wonderful metaphor for life. Do not invite something that will eat you to dinner. I mean, if you get it down to its lowest denominator, right? And then, of course, she gobbles all these different things all along the way. So she makes her way through Havana. She eats up all these different characters. But in the end, there are two little tiny characters who've been watching her. And though they can't beat her at her own game through strength, they can through cleverness, which is a wonderful lesson for children, especially because children are small, they're wee, they're powerless, but they can be clever.
For sure.
That's how you usually be.
Mm-hmm. I like
that. All right, so how about that?
Wonderfully done. So right on the cover of the book is your name, and right after it, in equally large type, the name of Henry Cole.
Yes.
And Henry Cole is responsible for the stunning illustrations. Tell us about your collaboration and his indispensable contribution to this wonderful book.
Well, Henry's an exquisite illustrator. I mean, he's been lauded in many different, and award-winning illustrator. And you know what? Here's the thing. We talked about it once. And then this is how it works. And the illustrator does what they will do. They will send, they'll ask for references sometimes, especially with Cubase. Is there anything, you know, what kind of hat would this man have worn, or specific things like that? Or what kind of goat would have been found in Cuba when, you know, because this was set sort of like in the era that my father was a child, which is when I learned the story, when he was an adult, pardon me. But the story, when I heard it, I envisioned it as being in the time of my father's own youth and childhood. So, you know, what kind of crackers? What do they look like? And then he just took off. And what I love is that it's big and bold and brassy, just like she is. He did this weird thing with the illustrations where it's in your face, as is Karina Felina. Oh, by the way, your pronunciation is unbelievable of Karina. And if you're it is. And if you're listening and you really say, oh, gosh, I can't say that, how am I going to order the book? Please use the English pronunciation. It's fine. I'm not precious. It's Karina Felina.
There you go.
Fine.
And by the way, at the end, we have definitions given to Spanish words that we find in this story. Mm-hmm. Last quick question. Mm-hmm. You dedicate this book to, or say it is for mm-hmm. Ruby, Sam, Grace, Brady, and Chloe, and for the courageous young people of El Movimiento San Isidro. Isidro. Tell us what is behind those words.
Oh, clever you. The Movimiento San Isidro is a blossoming pacifist, nonviolent movement in Cuba, comprised primarily of young people, many of them musicians and artists and creators, who are trying to bring democracy. And they are risking their lives to do it. And they don't have strength, but they have cleverness. And that's why this book is for them.
I love that. The book, again, is Karina Felina. It is published by Scholastic Press. And Carmen Agradidi, thank you so much for giving the world this wonderful book. And we wish you well as you continue to create wonderful stories for the world.
Oh, gosh, And Greg, continue doing what you're doing. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. Well, if you have young readers at home, then it's very, very likely that they have enjoyed or will enjoy at some point the best-selling Big Nate books, written and drawn by the very gifted Lincoln Pearce. I had the great pleasure of meeting Lincoln Pearce in person during one of the recent Kenosha Cartoonist Festivals, in which Ann Morse Hambrock and John Hambrock bring to town an array of superb cartoonists. And Lincoln Pearce was among, I think, the most recent group that came to Kenosha and entertained us all and joined us on The Morning Show. I'm really happy to reconnect with him via the telephone to talk about the most recent book in the series, Big Nate Lives It Up, and also to talk about the way in which the Big Nate phenomenon has sort of expanded in some exciting directions, one of which being in a new stage adaption, Big Nate the Musical. We'll be talking about that as well. Lincoln Pearce, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Great to talk to you again, Greg. Thank you.
I have to tell you about a little moment yesterday. My niece, Lorelai, is a voracious reader, and I was pretty sure that she had read some of your books, but when they came over last night for dinner and I asked her if she's read Big Nate books, and she nodded her head enthusiastically. And then I said, I get to interview the guy who does Big Nate. And she, without missing a beat, said, Lincoln Pearce? I mean, she knew your name by heart, which really impressed me. And then she went on to explain that when you were in town as part of this cartooning festival, I don't know that she knew anything about that, but you came to her elementary school. So that's how she happened to very specifically know and remember your name, even after all these months.
That was a blast. The Kenosha Festival was great fun, and part of that for me was, as you said, going around and visiting several local elementary schools, which is what I'm about to do. Actually, my publisher is sending me out on a book tour, and that for me means I visit a couple schools during the day, and then I'll go visit a bookstore in the evening. So that was a blast back in September in Kenosha, and I'm looking forward to doing more of it.
Very good. So for any of our listeners who, in fact, don't know what we're talking about in terms of Big Nate, I mean, if someone doesn't have children in their home anymore, then it's maybe fairly likely they haven't crossed paths with these books, or maybe they've done so as grandparents or something. But for the uninitiated, explain who Nate is and what these books are like.
Well, Big Nate started as a comic strip back in 1991, and Nate is a sixth grade boy. He's 11 years old, and he percolated along as the star of a comic strip for many, many years. And then just about 5 years ago, I got the opportunity to create chapter books featuring Big Nate, specifically for kids. And I had never written a book, but I was confident I could do it just because I'd lived with all the characters for so long at that point. And so these books are what is being referred to in the industry now as sort of hybrid books. They're a combination of comics and text. And for me, when I started the first one, I made it my goal to create a book that was going to be fun to read, the sort of book that I would have really enjoyed reading as a kid. And I was one of those visual kids who was always flipping through a book looking for the pictures and the fun stuff. And I think a lot of boys are so-called reluctant readers that way. And so in these books, kids will see comics on every page. The comics don't just illustrate the action. They're actually part of the action. They really propel the story along, and they're fun to read. Just, you know, that's I'm hoping that I'm succeeding in my goal, and kids seem to be responding. So the stories really center on Nate and his adventures, mostly in and around his school, because I'm a former school teacher myself, and as anyone who's spent any time in schools can tell you, you know, they're not always the funnest places for kids to spend their days, but in the long run, they really are hilarious and energetic places where a lot of things happen and a lot of childhood adventures and dramas unfold. And so that's really sort of the setting for all the Big Nate stories.
One of the things I really enjoy about these books, and specifically about the character of Nate, is that he feels, in a sense, very realistic. And not that everything that occurs to him or happens through the course of a book is entirely realistic, but he feels really authentic, and he's a very likable character without being, in a sense, too good, too spotless. I mean, he's not a particularly heroic figure, but we have a sense that he has a good heart. And he's just naughty enough to get into some trouble, but not into terrible trouble. And I don't know. I think you really strike a very interesting balance when it came to the way you created him. And it sounds like, to some extent, he was created at least a little bit as a reflection of who you were back in sixth grade. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. You know, I have kids of my own who are now, you know, in college and high school, and so they're long past Nate's age. But I'm often asked by people, "Did you get a lot of ideas from your kids?" And it's really not so much that. It's like you said, it's my own memories of being that age. And for whatever reason, I'm either blessed or cursed, however you want to say it, with a really vivid memory of what it was like when I was that age, when I was in sixth grade. I actually remember middle school much more clearly than I remember high school. I don't know why that is, but I tend to think it's just because that's such an eventful time in a kid's life. And, you know, you're transitioning from elementary to middle school, and so many things happen all of a sudden. Things that really weren't part of elementary school are part of your everyday life in middle school, with, you know, school dances, and you have six different teachers instead of just one, and all these things are different. And it's just a really eventful time. And I thank you for saying that Nate seems authentic, because that's always been one of my primary goals. Is, you know, there have been a lot of cartoon characters over the years who are children, but who are really sort of endowed with more adult personalities, and they speak in a way that a child really could never speak in the real world. And so I try to make, especially where the dialogue comes in, I just try to make Nate and his classmates sound like real sixth grade kids. You know, I don't want miniature adults. I want real kids. So so that's my goal, and thank you for saying so.
I wonder how much time and attention, and let's call it careful craftsmanship, goes into the shaping of each and every spread in a book like this, in this sort of hybrid format where we have some text and always lots and lots of illustrations, and each one of those illustrations sort of shaped in a different way. Sometimes it's a few squares as though we would find in a sequential comic strip in the newspaper, and sometimes it's isolated illustrations of one kind or another of various sizes and so on. And so there's a sort of relentless variety through the book, and yet it all hangs together really well. Does it just sort of happen spontaneously in terms of where the drawings will be and what they are, or is it kind of a painstaking process, a lot of trial and error to get it just right? I mean, how do these books, especially, I guess, visually, take shape?
Yeah, there's I wish it were more spontaneous than it is. there's a lot of planning that goes into it, because, you know, as I mentioned before, the drawings are really part of the story, so you can't just drop them in anywhere. You know, they really have to be specifically located. They have to be specifically sized so that they can coexist on a page with whatever text is also there. So So yeah, there's a lot that goes into it, and I sort of typeset them myself, if you will. You know, I have to create the text on my computer, and then I print out the pages without the illustrations, but leaving spaces for the illustrations, and then I sketch in the illustrations in rough form, and so that's what I guess you'd call the manuscript phase. And then when it comes time to create the finished art, then there's a lot of measuring, you know, sort of measure twice, draw once, because I want to make sure that it fits exactly where I want it to go and doesn't leave too much blank space on the page and all that. So, but when it's all said and done, I want it to seem, as you said, spontaneous. I want it to seem effortless, and I want the reading of it to be very easy, because when you're asking young kids to sort of read and jump back and forth between comics and text, you want it to flow, you know, you want it to go along, and you don't want the kids to be confused by the progression, and so hopefully it seems spontaneous.
It really does. It's just like watching good comedy on television. You want it to look like it's practically being improvised in front of your eyes. We don't like to see the effort that goes behind creating something that's fun and lighthearted. One interesting touch in this particular book is that the school is celebrating an anniversary, and towards that end, one of the teachers has gone into the archives and pulled out something by a student there from many, many, many decades earlier, Edna Burkdale, and her own efforts as a young cartoonist or doodler. And, of course, you've had great fun in these particular drawings because they evoke the comics of a whole another generation.
Yeah, I am a real fan of classic comics of the so-called golden era, and this was an opportunity for me to sort of explore that. And of course, in these stories, Nate draws his own comics, and this was a chance to look at the way an aspiring cartoonist might have approached things 100 years earlier. And it also, because this character, Edna Burkdale, was a girl, it was a chance to sort of remind my readers that, you know, even though these books are kind of boy-centric because, you know, Nate's a boy, and I think more people than not would characterize Big Nate as sort of more boys' books than girls, but I want to make it clear that, you know, girls read these books too, and, you know, Nate discovers through these 100-year-old comics, he discovers sort of a kindred spirit in this girl who was doing her own comics all those years ago. So, and it was my own way to kind of pay tribute, my loving tribute to, you know, comics of that era. So it was so much fun.
It was a great, great touch. And yes, my niece Lorelai will attest that girls also love the Big Nate books, that's for sure. I know that one thing that's been an exciting development was in May of last year when Big Nate became a musical. Just say a word about how that came about and how exciting that has been for you.
Well, there's a children's theater that's been in business for a long time in Glen Echo, Maryland, called Adventure Theater, and they proposed doing a Big Nate musical back in 2013, and we agreed, and I'm not a theater person, but they did a phenomenal job, and I sort of consulted on the script. I didn't do anything with the songs because that's not my area of expertise, but they did such a great job, and we, my family and I went down for the premiere, and then it was so well received in Maryland that they put together a touring company, and this past fall, they toured all around, and I think they might have even made it out your way, out in the Milwaukee area.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think right now it is being staged in Milwaukee, and it's been great fun. It's another format, another way to get Big Nate out there. So it's been a thrill.
A last question. This is going to get a little awkward, I'm afraid. I know that one of the things that you and the character of Big Nate have in trouble is you have no use for figure skating. So what's your beef with figure skating?
Well, I just come to it from a hockey playing standpoint. I grew up in New Hampshire. We had a pond behind our house, and it was always a battle between we who wanted to play hockey and those who wanted to figure skate. So that was where those battle lines were drawn. So I try not to be too critical of the figure skaters because, of course, I know how hard they work at their craft. But it's the sort of thing that I think, as you talked about authenticity, you know, it's the sort of thing that a sixth grade boy who really likes hockey and sports, that's the way he might think about figure skaters. So it's one of Nate's trilogy of things that he can't stand: figure skating, cats, and egg salad.
Well, I'm with him on egg salad, that's for sure. In the meantime,
I absolutely
enjoyed every single a Big Nate book that I have read, and enjoyed this latest one ever so much. And I hope a lot of people will check it out. Big Nate Lives It Up, which is published by Balzer and Bray, an imprint of HarperCollins. And the very talented man behind it, Lincoln Purse. Lincoln Purse, it's great to reconnect with you. Very best wishes to you and to Big Nate and all that stretches ahead for you.
Same to you, Greg. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is coming up in just a moment. I'm holding in my hands an absolutely lovely book, both to look at and to read, with a very important theme at its heart. The book is called The Proudest Color. And in this lovely children's book, picture book, we have a central character of Zara, who loves to think of the world around her and her interactions and her own feelings in bright colors. But she is also trying to come to terms with the fact that her skin is brown, unlike the skin color of nearly all of her schoolmates. And so it is kind of a journey that this beautiful youngster goes on, and we follow that journey in this book called The Proudest Color. And the book was created by a gifted couple, Sheila Modir and Jeff Kashu. Sheila Modir is a pediatric psychologist, and Jeffrey Kashu is a marriage and family therapist. And they happen to be Middle Eastern Americans who have worked very tirelessly on various issues related to diversity and equality. And this is their first children's book that they have created together. It's published by Familius, again called The Proudest Color. Sheila Modir and Jeff Kashu, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having us. We're really excited to be here, Greg.
Good morning. This is a pleasure. Thank you.
It's a lovely, lovely book. It really, really is. So your daily professional lives have nothing, at least directly, to do with creating children's books. So tell me how it occurred to you that this was something that should be done. I mean, that the world needed this book and that the two of you were the ones who should write it.
Yeah, absolutely. So this summer, in the wake of George Floyd's murder and the subsequent protests for social justice across the country, we recognized we had an opportunity to do something, and we weren't quite sure what. And reflecting on our own experiences, especially Sheila's growing up in some rural areas of Illinois, being the only person of color oftentimes in her communities, we recognized that this was just a really good opportunity for us to give children who were watching what was happening, for families who weren't sure how to talk about it with their children, a resource to help them understand and process, but then also to cope and build resilience in the face of it. We understand that we can't stop prejudice and racism and discrimination right away, but we definitely want to be able to control what is in our control, which is how we confront it. And also one thing I do want to mention at the top, if that's okay, is that we are donating our author's proceeds as well to the ACLU and other local social justice organizations here in California. Hmm.
I would love to hear more about whatever personal experiences you were able to draw upon in writing this book. Do any particularly powerful memories come to mind?
Yeah, I think that I actually grew up in Illinois, and I, similar to Zahra, I was one of the few people of brown skin tone in my class growing up. And so I was always aware of my appearances and the inability to blend in. I think in a class photo, you can see me a mile away, that I definitely, with my darker hair and darker skin tone, was standing out amongst my classmates. And so a lot of this book was based off of how I oftentimes, when I write about my experiences for autobiographical statements that I have to do for graduate school and so on, I talk about how I often felt like a crayon that wasn't used as much. And when I was used, I was the brightest color on the page. And I was able to take this experience and become a really good therapist from it, because I'm able to connect with all types of patients and be able to really understand their experiences, because I'm someone that was able to take, maybe I wasn't picked as often, but when I was, I added so much more to the page or to a room. And so when we were sitting down to write, I thought of that experience and I was really able to channel it. I also think that for a lot of Middle Eastern Americans, same with Jeff as well, there after September 11th, discrimination towards this community increased tremendously and continues to increase. And so I think that that was a really formative experience for many of us in the community. And that's the experience that really we draw on when we think about the discriminations that we have experienced. Mm-hmm.
I gave the very briefest of summaries of the sort of the essential plot of the story, but why don't you tell the story to our listeners in just a little bit more detail in terms of what this young girl named Zahra experiences.
Of course. So you first meet Zahra. She's described as somebody who sees and feels in color. So we bring in some emotional identification into the book as well, just for a mental health theme. And then as she prepares for her first day of school, she's being put to bed by her mother, and they're discussing how proud they are of all the colors they felt during the day, but especially the one that stays and that they see when they look in the mirror, which is the color brown, and her mother admiring their different shades of brown even between them. And when Zahra goes to school the next day, it's her first day, she recognizes that nobody else looks like her, and she pauses for a moment, but then remembers how proud she is of her color, and it instills a sense of confidence in her. Soon after that, a white classmate of hers points out that Zahra doesn't look like anyone else and puts her down for it. That causes Zahra then to question her pride and her color. And so when she comes home, she tells her parents about this, and her parents then engage her in a evidence-based practice called racial socialization, which is socializing her to others in her world who are of her skin tone, who have gone on to do amazing and incredible things in her world, to rebuild that sense of pride in her skin tone and her race and others who look like her.
Can you tell us what it was like to shape this story and the kinds of questions that you wrestled with in terms of exactly how you wanted to explore this story? Because, of course, you had an infinite number of possible choices at every stage, and you were doing this for the first time. So help us understand what the process was like for crafting this book.
I think a children's book is just a whole different area. You know, I'm used to writing dissertations or scholarly articles, so having to sit down and write things of such depth in a developmentally appropriate manner, or in a way that, you know, five-year-olds can understand it or parents can feel comfortable talking about it, was definitely a new avenue for us. So really being able to shape a story that is approachable, relatable, and can really stay with someone. You know, we want it to be memorable because we want this story to be able to elicit change and for children to be able to remember Zahra's journey when they enter their first day of school or when they enter a classroom or a store and they don't feel like anybody else in that room. So really, it was definitely a process to find out how to be able to do this that in the right language.
Yeah, and I'll add to that as well. You know, with the interaction that she has with her classmate who discriminates against her, we had an interesting process even with our editor in determining, you know, how we wanted to close up that story, making it developmentally appropriate. And, you know, it is a children's book at the end of the day, but also not putting the onus on the person of color to heal the story. So we were able to institute some elements of anti-racism as well in that part of this. So it was fun crafting this book.
I wonder if it was harder than you expected it to be. And I only ask that because I think a lot of people kind of make blithe assumptions about how difficult it is to craft a book for children versus a book written for adults. And obviously, it's shorter, fewer pages, many fewer words and that sort of thing. And yet it has its own challenges that can be tremendously difficult. Was it for you?
Definitely. I think that's a great question, because you know what the most difficult part was is who there's so many important and incredible people of color that we wanted to include in this book. So there's a part where Zahra's parents explain to her all the important people that share her skin tone. You know, so we're talking about Barack Obama, Frida Kahlo, Malala Yousafzai, Martin Luther King Jr. And so she is thinking of all of these incredible people and relating to them. And so when Jeff and I were sitting down and writing about each person, you know, Cesar Chavez, there's so many that we could have included. And I think that that was definitely an area of struggle because we wanted to make sure that we represented the entire brown community. But fortunately, there's so many incredible people to pick from, but unfortunately, we weren't able to put it in all of them in a children's book. So I think that's an area that I wish I could just like have this comprehensive list for children to be able to access, because there's so many important people out there.
That's a very moving part of the book, that's for sure. By the way, we would certainly be remiss if we didn't make mention of the talented artist who is responsible for the illustrations. What do you want to tell us about her?
Yeah, Monica is just such a brilliant illustrator. We're so fortunate that Familius found her and shared her with us. You know, she brought in a lot of her own story, her own experience as well. It was just a completely positive experience crafting this story with her. I mean, and we were just blown away every time she came back with something. There's elements in the book, too, that she introduced that we hadn't expected, that really elevated the process as well. She made the book very neurodiverse, accessible too for kids who learn a little bit differently. She introduced a path, like a crayon path of color that trails Zahra throughout her story that changes color based on her emotions that she identified earlier on. She also brought in this adorable little cat that's her kind of partner, who is with her through all the highs and lows of the story. So we're just so fortunate that Monica took this project on with us and brought it to a level we never really could have imagined.
The book at the very end includes a note to parents and caregivers, which is really a marvelous addition to the proceedings. And I don't remember seeing anything quite like this before in a children's book. Explain what the reader finds here on this page called, again, A Note to Parents and Caregivers.
Yeah, so in this, when we wrote this book, we were really wanting to make sure we had this note because we want to use this book as a tool, or we would like parents to use this book as a tool as they explain race and racism to their child. There really isn't a book out there that really openly and explicitly talks about racism among children in this age group. And so this is very much explicitly an experience happens and skin color is questioned. So we wanted to make sure that parents had a guide to be able to navigate sometimes this difficult or for them sometimes an uncomfortable conversation. And so in this guide, we have some different pointers and tips on how to be able to have this conversation. For example, we don't want parents to feel like they have to talk about everything all at once, you know, to sit the child down and have this deep discussion about racism. This is a conversation that should be ongoing in the home. It should be something that we don't take a colorblind approach, right? There's families that say, you know, we don't see color and we are all in this together, which is not necessarily true. There are groups that are treated historically unfairly and continue to be treated unfairly. So we want families to be able to have these conversations, all of them based in the current reality that we're in, multiple conversations as a child goes through different developmental stages, and to be able to use tools like children's books and even tools like Crayola's skin tone crayons and markers. Those are incredible. Or dolls that portray different races and ethnicities. So to be able to help expose their child to diverse groups. So those are just some of those tips that we put in there, and we hope that parents can be able to utilize.
It's a really lovely list. I really think that's neat. A last quick question. You touched on the fact that the period immediately after 9/11 was difficult for people of Middle Eastern descent. I wonder what it has been like for you to experience this 20th anniversary, which was just commemorated. I suspect it might have brought back some difficult memories for you.
Yeah, thank you so much for that question. You know, of course, it's such a mixed day for us because it obviously brings about all the pain and sadness for everyone who was lost so senselessly that day. And additionally, you're just constantly reminded of, you know, I can think back to when I was in high school and, you know, showing up to my different classes and feeling all the eyes on me, or a teacher even asking, you know, what should we do? Should we nuke them? Should we go to war with them? I don't know, it's like, you know, I have family there. Maybe we should take a different approach. You know, and just that, you know, it kind of bolsters your sense of identity at the same time of also now having to constantly think about how it's brought up in conversation. It's something I can speak for myself. I haven't really shook to this day being Palestinian American and, you know, always wondering, do I mention that fact or not, or do I just say I'm, you know, Middle Eastern or Arab descent?
Hmm. A difficult day for all of us, and a lot of important lessons we hope have been learned. Will you be writing another children's book together, do you think?
We hope so. We definitely hope that this isn't our last one. We have a lot of different mental health themed messages that we'd like to impart on children. This is, you know, we see this in our therapy offices, so we want to make sure that we're capturing and writing about it for parents.
This book, again, is lovely and called The Proudest Color. It's published by Familius. Its co-authors Sheila Modir and Jeff Kashu. Thank you so much for giving the world this lovely book, and thank you for being part of The Morning Show today.
Thank you so much
having
us. Over the weekend, we'll have some interesting Morning Show archival interviews shared in the podcast version of the program. Tomorrow, because the U.S. Open Tennis Championships is going on right now, I'm replaying my 2010 conversation with Patrick McEnroe, former tennis pro and now highly regarded tennis commentator and coach. On Sunday, a look back at the tumultuous career of astronomer Johannes Kepler, with the author of a biography of him called Kepler's Witch. On Monday, on Labor Day, we'll have some fun with the author of a book called Modern Family, the untold oral history of one of television's groundbreaking sitcoms. That will be on Monday, Labor Day, and there'll be no broadcast of the morning show because our studios will be closed. But you can still hear the morning show by listening to the podcast. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Next week, our broadcast of The Morning Show will include on Tuesday a visit from Dr. Thomas Carr, who heads up the paleontology program at Carthage College. On Wednesday, a look at transgender history. On Thursday, a visit from Dr. Art Sear, who is a monthly visitor to The Morning Show, offering his analysis and reflection on various current events and issues.